This morning, as we continue our study of the subject that I call the God who is there, and looking at the subject of atheism, as it's called, and agnosticism and skepticism, these alternative views about spiritual things and the world that seems to be in the ascendancy in our culture right now, we come to that part today where we talk about how do you defend what you believe. In 1986, Landon Saunders, an early speaker on the program that came out of Abilene for many, many years called Herald of Truth, and later who moved to the Northeast and began a very successful long-time ministry up there called Heartbeat. In 1986, in a sermon he delivered in Nashville, Tennessee, proposed the idea that Christianity has moved into uncharted waters in our world. And as he went on to explain, he observed that when we look at history, it is impossible to find any record of a significant movement toward atheism in the world prior to the late 1600s. And even then, when you start seeing small organized groups of people who profess to not believe in any God at all, these people were pushed out onto the fringes of society. They found it impossible to get their books published. They found it impossible to get an audience for the things they were saying. In England, even, if you were a professed atheist, you always faced the threat that the state would actually come in and take your children away from you because you were considered an unfit parent. And yet in the 300 years since that time, when you first could identify anywhere in the world, at any time in history, a specific group of people who actually openly espouse belief in no God at all, and tried to live their lives and shape their values based on that, atheism has made a great deal of advancement. Now, this is not to say that there were not people always in history who individually didn't believe in any God. We know the Scriptures make references to that. Even in the Psalms, we hear the psalmist say that someone has said in their heart, there is no God. But they were almost like random individuals who were that way. They were not an organized, well-recognized group of people. And especially in the last 100 years, this belief in atheism, and it is a belief system. Some might try to convince you that atheism is not a religion. It is a religion because it's a belief system. It is a certain set of beliefs about this life and the next life, the spiritual life, as well as the physical life. This atheism and the allied views that are often referred to as agnosticism, doubt that there is a God, or skepticism, being skeptical about anything that has to do with God or religion. In the last 100 years, great advances have been made by this group of people, especially in our culture. Now, we find that this belief system is in the ascendancy, and we are in the decline in our own culture. Now, maybe someone would say, well, don't they still come out with the surveys that show that 80-something percent of people in America believe in a God, and 60-something percent of people claim that they pray, and that less than 30% of people go to church or do anything that publicly indicates they're religious? Yes, we still outnumber them, if you want to count numbers. But do we out-influence them in our culture? Think about some things with me. Right now in our culture, which way of thinking, that there is a God in heaven, that He has given us a law that's both moral and practical, and that we ought to honor Him and revere Him, we ought to pray to Him, and we look forward to a life after this with Him, that's the religion of Christianity, and that we sin and we fall short of His glory, and that He sent His own Son to die for us, and we need to respond to what God has done and pledge our allegiance to Jesus all of our life. That's Christianity. Or this other view that says God has no place in our culture because He's not really there. And we shouldn't push any such belief off on other people. Which of those two views controls the big media in our country? That controls Hollywood, the movies that are produced, that controls our televisions and controls the shows that are shown on the national networks and many of the cable networks. I think it's pretty obvious who controls those. It's not people who are Bible believers and Christians who are willing to let what they believe show in the works they produce. Rather, it's either people who have no such beliefs, or if they do, they have been shut out by the system as a whole from producing anything that reflects that in any significant way. What is true of Hollywood and what it produces is also true most of our news media, on the national level at least. Occasionally stories will appear in which someone is allowed to express their faith, or in which they will somehow praise some religious group because of some good they did. But certainly they don't want to give very much attention to what they actually believe and what they profess, except in the most generic ways. It's much more likely that you'll be reading stories about abuses and failures and sins that take place in churches and in religious leaders. They control the media. At least this way of thinking is controlling our media. Well, which group of thinking controls our scientific community? We look to our scientific community as the future. Not just the present, but the future. For it's from there that new inventions and new patents and new discoveries in every area, from astrophysics to biology to medicine, come. Which way of thinking controls that community? A man or a woman who believes in God and is willing to profess that finds it almost impossible to get their writings published in the scientific community. Some even deem them unfit parents, and if they had the power, they would take their children away from them and place them with atheists, because they believe those who believe in a God and in the Bible and in Jesus are teaching a gross superstition that does much more evil than good. Well, who's in the ascendancy in our educational system? Maybe there we can find that we still have the most influence. In our universities, in our public schools. From the news last night, Poteet High School here in Texas, out of fear of lawsuits because the valedictorian claims to be an atheist, have dispensed with prayer at graduation, of reading any scripture at graduation, because another high school near them went through a year-long litigation and spent hundreds of thousands of the school district's money to defend themselves against a lawsuit because they had prayer at graduation the year before. Who's in the ascendancy? When it comes to public policy, those in public office, those who serve in our Congress, those who serve even in our state houses, who's in the ascendancy? Are not laws being implemented every day, it seems, that says more and more that the state does not designate what's moral or immoral, no longer will support the Judeo-Christian view of what is right and wrong, but only determine what is harmful to other people or not? So if people of the same gender want to get married, what's the state to do about it? That's okay by them. If people want to live outside of wedlock, state for a long time has already said, that's none of our business. But if somebody wants to say, well, I'm a Christian, and so I want to be able to say that I'm a Christian, the state steps in and says, no, you can't do that. You have to keep your belief to yourself. Now, you don't have to keep your unbelief to yourself. You can shout that as loudly as you want and file lawsuits in court and everything else to get your right to unbelief. But those who believe don't seem to have such rights. Now, I don't intend this to be a rant, but I'm telling you, in the history of the world, God's people have never faced this kind of challenge before. In the Old Testament, in the New Testament, up until just the last 200 years, what we've mostly faced is other faith systems, either in other gods or other views of God. But now we face the challenge of belief in no God. And as far as I can tell, that will continue and increase and accelerate. And our children, our grandchildren, and our great-grands, and those after them, will more and more find themselves in a world in which belief in no God is not only accepted, but popular, and maybe even the majority. And they will find, if they have faith, they will be persecuted, and they will be shut out. But the truth of the matter is, as surveys are showing, we're losing many of our own grandchildren and great-grandchildren to this thought system already. We haven't done, and probably we're not doing, a very good job of giving them the reasons to believe sufficient to fortify them against the pressures they feel that come from the other view. You remember the statement, "Just the facts, ma'am"? That's often attributed to a TV character, and I guess before that it was actually a radio character called Joe Friday, in the popular radio and later television series called Dragnet. I understand that the truth is he never said that. People have gone back and watched every episode and listened to every radio episode, and he never said exactly that. It actually comes from a parody that someone was making of the show and making a joke about it, in which they said, "Just the facts, ma'am." In fact, Joe Friday on a number of occasions did say in that series, "All we want are the facts, ma'am," when he would be interviewing women who were being a little reticent in one way or another to tell what they knew about something. Well, that's what we want, and that's what we need to give out to, first of all, our own, but then to the world around us. We need more than ever before to be equipped and capable and willing to not only know why we believe in God and the things we do, but to tell others in a convincing enough way that the possibility at least exists that they will come to faith as well. When we look in the Old Testament and the New Testament, we see that those believers face the same kind of challenge, not of belief in no God, but unbelief in the God they believed in, at least, because all the nations and the peoples around them were believers in other gods, either one or many. And how did they respond to that? How did they defend their faith? How did they advance the cause they believed in such an environment? Well, in the Old Testament, the evidence is a little unclear at times about how they did that. But some of the things I have observed in the Old Testament is they constantly appealed to the historical facts of how God had been with them. They told the story over and over, both for the unbeliever out there and for their own families, their own children and grandchildren. They ingrained it into their thinking that they were a called, chosen people. They told over and over the story of Adam and Eve and Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, of the trip down to Egypt and God bringing them out of Egypt with a mighty hand and great demonstrations of His power. And once He had brought them back into this land, that He had been with them through thick and thin, through good and bad, through evil on their part and times when they were faithful to Him. And they used this to ingrain in their children who they were and whose they were, and to believe without question in God and His will for their life. As a result of that, it caused them to a certain degree to be isolationist. Part of their way of protecting themselves and their children from false belief systems around them was to live together and separate themselves from these others who believed in Molech or the gods of Egypt or the gods of Assyria. And so we even find in a book like Jonah, where Jonah is called to go preach to some people who believed in totally different gods than the God he believed in, totally reticent to go because he had become so isolationist in his own thinking. They didn't believe in pluralism in the way it's used today. Now, don't take me wrong and think that I'm advocating that we somehow start a movement to try to make America into a Christian exclusive country. Even if I believed in that, it's far beyond the ability to do that anyway. That, in fact, has never been what our nation has been about. But they certainly rejected such ideas in the Jewish community in the Old Testament, that they would even tolerate alternative points of view on this subject. Well, in the New Testament, things were different, because we're not talking about a nation that was committed to the belief in God and serving Him in a certain way, according to the laws of Moses and so forth. Instead, we find a new movement starting up that has come to believe that Jesus was the Son of God, that He was sent into the world by God to save man from their sins, that men need to respond to that message and live their lives in response to it. And so what we see in the New Testament is a continual emphasis and a continual presentation of what they believed and why they believed it in an effort to convince others and persuade others of the truth. Peter, in his letter, 1 Peter, is writing at a time when Christianity has been around now long enough that they're moving into a period of persecution. The Roman government has finally taken notice of Christianity, and it doesn't like what it sees. It sees Christianity as somehow opposed to or contrary to the values of the Roman Empire. For it turned out to be true, after all, that Christians were advocating another king named Jesus. That's what Jesus himself was accused of when the Jews hauled him up before Pilate to have him crucified. That turned out to be true. Christians did believe in another king besides the emperor. And yes, when push came to shove, they were going to obey their king, not the one in Rome. Otherwise, they were good citizens. But Rome could not tolerate that, and so persecution was beginning. And as Peter was trying to equip Christians in his generation to face that and still be faithful to what they believed, he went further than just to tell them to be faithful to what they believed and to endure the suffering that was coming upon them. But he told them to live exemplary lives among the unbelievers that would put the lie to a lot of the things they were being accused of falsely. But they needed to even go further than to live exemplary lives before the unbelievers. For he says in 1 Peter chapter 3 and in verse 15, "But in your hearts set apart Christ as Lord, and always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have, and do this with gentleness and respect." Peter said, be prepared to tell people why you believe what you believe. I think for so long in our country, for generation after generation, the vast majority of people have said they believed in God, and the vast majority of them said they believed in the fundamental things of the Bible, and they believed in Jesus, and they believed in church, and they believed in sin, and they believed in forgiveness of sin, that we've forgotten why we believe. We just believe. We no longer even know how to tell people what we believe and why, in a persuasive enough way that it might actually convince somebody else. And so most of the people in our world who no longer believe think Christians really don't have a good reason for what they believe. They just believe it. And so they're unpersuaded by our unpersuasiveness. It's time we change that. Otherwise, we will continue to see the vast majority of our own leave us for this other thinking system, this other philosophy or thought system, when in fact there are, in my opinion, better reasons by far to believe what we believe than the other. But we've just not told anyone about it. Peter here says that they need to give an answer. Actually, in the Greek language, the word there is give an apology an apologia. Now today we use the word apology in totally the different way than what it originally meant. Today, an apology is we say, we're sorry for something. Please forgive me. But that's not what the word meant when he used it, and for a great long time afterwards. Instead, the word apology meant to give a defense, to give an answer, to give an explanation. It actually was a legal term. And it appears, counting here, 8 times in our New Testament. Paul will stand up in Acts chapter 22 before the Sanhedrin. And then later he'll stand up, we know, before kings and governors and do the same thing. And he will say, hear my defense. Hear my apologia. Hear my answer to the things that were being said concerning him. He will write to the Philippians in chapter 1 and verse 7, saying that I am set. Literally, he was saying, I have been chosen for the defense and the confirmation of the gospel. Paul said part of his job as an apostle was to defend belief in the gospel and to provide confirmation of it. I think that's probably where the ability given by God through the Holy Spirit for him to do miraculous things, and even his willingness and ability to stand up and say, once I believed like you did, and I thought I would do everything possible to oppose what I now believe in, that was his confirmation. That's how he was confirming the gospel. And again, in verse 16 of that same Philippians chapter 1, he said, I am set for the defense of the gospel. And we have many examples in our New Testament of them defending the gospel. We don't often think of them in that way, but that's actually what they existed for. They were as if they were in a court of public opinion, and there was the other side presenting their view, and here were the Christians presenting their defense. When we look at the Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, these are nothing but defenses of what Christians believed and why. It was a presentation of the historical facts concerning Jesus, where he came from, what he did, what he said, how he did miracles, how he was crucified, how he rose from the dead, how he ascended back to heaven. It was the defense of the gospel. The book of Acts is a defense of the spreading of the gospel. The methods they used, the reasons why they did it, the response of people to it. It is actually an apologia of the spread of the gospel. And then numerous passages within the writings of the Apostle Paul and in the story of the Apostle Paul in the book of Acts provide the same thing. We know when he stood on Mars Hill in Acts 17, he's standing before a group of philosophers and men who had strong, definite ideas about God and right and wrong and so forth, and those didn't match up at all with what the gospel was teaching. And so he was given the invitation to speak to them, and he says, as I came through your city, I observe, among other things, that you were a very religious people, but also that you even had an altar to an unknown God. I am going to tell you about that God today. And he did a convincing enough job that a small group of the people who listened to him were convinced, and the greater number of them started to oppose, argue against him. They could see the persuasiveness of the evidence he was presenting, and so they start presenting their side of the case. And so a lot of public dialogue took place in the city of Athens as a result of that, and the church was established there. Even the book of Hebrews is an apologia, a defense of the gospel. But it was an apologia to the Jews, not to the Gentiles, in which the writer is defending faith in Jesus as the chosen one from God, the one Moses spoke about, the one that the priest of the Old Testament prefigured, the one that the tabernacle and the temple illustrated by their very construction and the things that were carried on in them. It's an apologia. They appeal to the evidence. They argue from history and from eyewitness testimony about the truth of these things. We more than ever before, must be equipped ourselves and support those who might be champions on our behalf to do that in public ways. As our world, especially our culture here in America, is going to become more and more one without God, what we believe can be defended. And there are many out there already trying to do it, even if we're unaware of it. But we need ourselves to be equipped and to be diligent in passing that knowledge on to those we have influence with. If I were to actually ask us this morning, why do you believe in God? What would your answer be? Why do you believe in Jesus and the gospel? What would your answer be? Would you feel uncomfortable as you tried to even come up with an answer? You don't need to be. It doesn't have to be that way. You can be far more confident in your faith than that. We must be conversant, capable, and active in presenting the evidence and making it clear in our community and to those we have contact with that we have a reason for the hope that we hold dear. In Hebrews 11:1, that was read to us at the beginning, the Hebrew writer, as he begins a chapter on faith in his book, remember it was an apologia, a defense of the gospel to Jews, he wants them to realize that their own faith as Jews was rested upon faith. And he says at the very outset in chapter 11:1, now faith is being sure of what we hope for. I memorized that originally in the King James Version. Now faith is the substance of things hoped for. The word there in the Greek language is used just a few times. Seems like only two or three in the whole New Testament. But it's a well-known word among Greek-speaking people of that time. The word substance actually meant the foundation, the underpinning, the support. And he's not giving a definition of faith here. He's giving a description of faith. He says, now faith is the support of what we hope for. We have come to a point where we feel like we have a foundation upon which we can stand about the things we believe that are still to come, what we hope for. And faith is being certain of those things we do not see. We've already talked about the fact that our God is an invisible God. And he'll say later in this same chapter about Moses that he saw him who was invisible. Now, he's not talking about what Moses saw up on Mount Sinai. He's talking about that Moses in his heart, in his mind, knew the reality of a God that his eyes couldn't see. That's what faith is for us as well. It's the certainty, it's being certain of that which we cannot see with our physical eyes, but still we have total confidence of its truth and its existence. But we'll continue this discussion next week as we actually start talking about what's the evidence for our side. Now I realize that when we start presenting the evidence, it doesn't blow everybody away, so to speak. We won't suddenly find that prominent atheists will say, oh, how wrong I was. I just never knew the evidence before. But that has and does, in fact, happen. There are a large number of people who were once persuaded by atheism who now are devout Christians. They just never had the evidence presented to them before. All they ever got to hear was one side of the argument before. But once someone, by some means, started to present the evidence to them, they started looking at it more closely and studying it more deeply and became convinced of the truth of it. So it can be persuasive, even if not everyone will believe. We have an invitation song. Because what we're talking about ultimately is, did what happened at Calvary really make any difference at all? Was it just a man who got crossways with the establishment in his generation and was killed to silence him? Or was he, in fact, the Savior, the one who died for the sins of all mankind?